Sorry. With that, why don't we? This can be the beginning of Q&A.
A really quick question.
Yeah.
There are some models.
Please use the mic.
There are some models internationally.
That's on.
Like the Grameen banks, Axion, which does a lot of micro loans.
What was the first one you said? I'm sorry. What was the first one you said?
Grameen banks in Bangladesh.
Yep.
Their rate of default has been extremely low in terms of payback is, you know, much better than most commercial banks in terms of the rate of default.
Yes, so I mean, to some extent, I think what you're talking about is some of the sort of micro-lending programs. Those are a bit of a different beast. They are, not only are they micro, right? They're small. We're talking about small loans here, but they're talking about much smaller amounts, right? We're talking about billions of dollars that the U.S. Postal Service would be dealing with. But also, they're very targeted, right? They tend to be lending almost exclusively to local individuals who are trying to set up small businesses or cottage industries, right? And as such, they are both, you know, they're doing a certain kind of risk assessment. They're not lending it to everyone with a half-baked idea. And they're basically only doing what you might call small business or commercial lending. With, say, the U.S. postal system, which is not to discount that finding, right? It is true. It isn't, you know, it's not the case that everyone don't have money, you know, that they're not wealthy on some level, that they can't pay loans back. I think that's an important point conceptually. But when you're talking about what the U.S. postal system would do, it would be a much larger and different categories of lending. It would be lending to individuals who basically, when people need to take advantage of these loans, it's essentially because they have a debt. Basically, they've gotten in over their head in one way or another. They can't make ends meet. That's why they wind up at payday lenders. Right, they just need like probably a few hundred bucks to cover a mortgage or a medical bill or something. It's often not large amounts, but if you don't have a savings account, if you can't go into the traditional banking system, you know, you're screwed. You wind up having to go to payday lenders, but they're not mostly borrowing the money to start up a, you know, weaving enterprise or, you know, whatever else, recycling or something that these micro lenders tend to incent in third world.
I want to say thank you very much, Sam Munger, for a very interesting, informative talk. And I have to say I was struck by how Dan Cornwell wants to speak at the end. He has something he wants to talk about, how this just kind of feeds into what Dan has to say. So I do want to open it up now to questions, and I'll bring the microphone around. So David Leeper?
Yeah, I just wanted to ask, is there any social or economic reason that we have to allow people to borrow money in situations where they probably can't pay it back? You know, you're saying just get caught up a little bit, but have you done some study or research? Because probably when they get caught up that little bit, then they're going to just be that much farther behind at 400%. And what I'm thinking about is, I was interning at Department of Justice back in the 70s, and we had usury laws, 12%. Nobody could loan money at more than that. Why can't we do that? Wouldn't that be a sound practice for a state to say, yeah, we simply don't allow lenders to charge more than that? Why wouldn't that work?
So I feel like there were sort of two things maybe that you raised. I'm not sure I'm getting the first half of the question correct, but as to the latter, what's that? Okay. So you weren't asking why. I thought you were asking why should we allow people who who go into debt and probably won't be able to pay it back to borrow money at all. But you're saying, okay. So let me take the second one first, because I think it's easier in some ways. Or, you know, there's an answer there. There are lots of efforts to reform the payday lending industry. And I think it's totally reasonable, not totally reasonable, it's somewhat insane not to have caps on interest rates. And plenty of states do. I shouldn't say plenty of states. But some states do. Some states have moved in that direction. I mean, states move back and forth. Sorry. Some states have instituted caps on interest rates. They tend to be a little bit higher than 12% these days. You know, it's more up in the 30 or 40 range, but it's still way different than 400. Some states have had them for a long time. They've had these historic usury laws. And in fact, almost every state at one time or another had a usury law on its books that capped the percent that financial institutions could charge. And essentially, they were removed by industry. They were lobbied out of existence. The payday lending industry is an incredibly active political player. It's an active lobbyer. It's very influential in state governments, and this is a debate that's come up in Wisconsin off and on, right? And came up recently. I'm trying to remember. There was a... I'm going to get my particulars wrong. I'm actually not as good on Wisconsin politics as I should be, but in the sort of Janesville area, there was a recent race for state legislature, or a primary for state legislature, and one of the candidates was a former state legislator who had essentially, you know, had voted against caps on payday lending, voting against caps on interest rates, and was being taken to task by other people. And he had done it after he had actually literally had a relationship with the lobbyist for the payday lending industry, I think. Does this ring a bell? I can't remember the names anymore, but I can look it up. At any rate, It's essentially a political problem, right? We should absolutely have caps on interest rates, even for, you know what I mean, in any event, irrespective of what the U.S. postal system does. We should reform the payday lending industry, basically out of existence. I mean, it's essentially just it's parasitic on some level. Not that there's a role for sort of submarket or subprime consumer lending. There's a role in lending to people who are bad credit risks. I mean, you do have to have kind of specialized loans and instruments and maybe institutions. They just don't have to charge 400% and have these sort of crazy, deceptive refinancing schemes. Your first question as to why or whether we should be lending credit to folks who are bad credit risks. I mean, I think the answer, so somewhere in here, in the U.S. postal system, report, it shows that most of these folks, I mean, as I was sort of alluding to, most of these people who wind up taking advantage of the payday lending industry owe relatively small amounts. It's mostly to pay off medical bills or sort of a one-time charge. It's not sort of chronic, I mean, it may be chronic indebtedness, but it's individual expenses that just exceed their ability to pay for the moment. And I think it is, you know, it's, and sorry, as an, you know, part of that, they show that some huge percentage of people who end up declaring bankruptcy owe relatively little money. It's just they have even less money to pay it back. And I think it's in society's interest, really, to prevent those people from winding up in a cycle of indebtedness, of interest, of fees, of sort of winding up unable to be a part of the mainstream economy because they're perennially in debt or they're in bankruptcy. I think, you know, we can think about what the best mechanisms are for giving those people bridge loans effectively, for helping them pay back their, you know, sort of have credit, you know, pay off their loan temporarily and then pay off that, or sort of pay off their debt temporarily and then pay off that loan gradually. A lot of these people, I mean, the payday lending industry, I mean, it's very clever and also sort of various. I mean, they don't lend money to people who don't have income. What's the point? You know, if these people can't pay some percentage of their crazy fees, they are going to lose money. They tend to pay to people who have some debt and also have some income stream that the payday lending industry can go after. So these aren't people who are penniless per se. They have income. They're employed usually. They have money coming in. And I think it's, you know, in society's interest, I think we should be giving them 0% loans to cover their debt until they can sort of gradually pay it back, or very low interest loans. I think, you know, essentially it would cost us all less in the long term.
I have a question, and I have some other ones, but I'll wait until other people have theirs. First are, what are the four or five big banks that you're talking about? And secondly, how are they connected with the foreign-owned banks?
Well, so the four or five big banks, I should totally have them off the top of my head, but it's essentially, it's J.P. Morgan Chase, Citibank, U.S. Bank, Bank of America, and I'm forgetting the fifth one, but you could look it up online. Look for, yeah, J.P. Morgan Chase was the first one that I mentioned. If you Google Big Five banks, you know, Big Five banks U.S., you will get the list, and there's lots of lists of their assets. You know, shows how much they each hold. Didn't Wells Fargo sort of effectively go belly up and get absorbed by someone else in the banking crisis? What's that? So Goldman Sachs is an investment bank. There's not really, post-Glass-Steagall, there's not that much of a real distinction between investment banks and other banks, but they don't they don't take a lot of consumer deposits, and so they don't technically get included in that. If we have an internet connection, I'll look it up here. Or I'll look it up on my phone. And the second part of your question was about foreign-owned banks?
Yeah, how are they connected with the foreign banks? In other words, big banks in a foreign country might own or partially own some of these banks here, and how are those negative cards using funds?
Well, I mean, all of these banks are, you know, they're all multinational companies. They're not, when we say it's the big five banks in the United States, we should think of that as, as market share. They're the big five banks in the U.S. because U.S. citizens and companies put their money there, not because they're U.S. companies in any real way. I mean, I think, you know, when we talk about the modern global economy, increasingly these companies aren't, you know, they're not citizens of any country. J.P. Morgan Chase has offices all over. They put, you know, they keep most of their money outside of the U.S. so that they don't have to pay taxes on it. They, you know, they're effectively completely... they're at least like citizens of the world. They're independent in some way, and they don't. It's funny, they're too big to fail because it would tank the U.S. economy, not because they are dependent on us in any way. They're perfectly happy to, I think, on some level, to run the U.S. economy into the ground, you know, to bleed it dry and to see it crash, because they'll just pick up and go to another country. I mean, they're already in every country in the world. So, you know, yes, there's foreign, you know, Credit Suisse, Barclays, you know, those are technically foreign banks in that they are, you know, they're headquartered, I guess, or, you know, nominally citizens of either Switzerland or London. Barclays has a bigger share of the British market than J.P. Morgan Chase, but they are functionally interchangeable. They're all doing the same stuff. They're all part of the same system. They play, to the extent that they have to, they play by the regulatory rules of whatever nation state they're doing business in. So when Barclays is in the U.S., it plays by U.S. regulatory rules, which tend to be relatively modest, let's say. When J.P. Morgan Chase is in England or in Europe, you know, they have to comply with higher regulatory standards. That's just sort of the, you know, when they do transactions there. But they're all the same. They're all, you know, they're all owned by the same people on some level, and they're doing all the same stuff.
Excuse me. I have two questions. I'd like you to answer the first one before I ask the second one.
Sure.
I've been hearing about this flap over this new agency that the governor has created to take the place of the Commerce Department, and I forget exactly the letters that represent it, but...
Sure.
They have been taking on the functions of a bank, more or less. They've been lending money. I've been reading in the newspaper about how they're lending money to companies outside of Wisconsin, and I thought the whole idea was to help Wisconsin businesses and also not taking any, not investigating whether they're getting paid back or, I mean, all kinds of irregularities, and I wondered how that could be transmuted into a state bank in some way. It seems like it's similar.
Yeah. This is a good point, and let me see if I can give a shorter answer to that. All right, sorry. Let me see if I can give a relatively not short answer. I doubt I can. All states have engage in economic development activities, basically giving money to private entities that they think are, or to, you know, incent certain kinds of business and economic development in their state. So, you know, when you think about the way the city of Madison might give a little startup loan to a local business, or might create a little tech incubator where, you know, sort of little tech businesses can flourish, or the way that there's public money that goes to trying to take biotech innovations from UW stem cells and turn them into, you know, into profitable businesses or turn them into things that are going to employ lots of people. I mean, every state engages in that in some level. On a way too big level, frankly. The states put way too much money into private businesses and don't get nearly enough back. And we could talk about, you know, how you change that and whether you can change that and so on. So all states do that. It's all in the form of loans. It's not there's various things that distinguish a bank, but one of the things that, say, Alan Brown will tell you is that what a bank does is it has a certain amount of capital. It has a sort of pool of money that it basically holds in reserve. And by being chartered as a bank and certified to do it, it can lend out way more money that it doesn't actually exactly have. That it's money that in theory is going to come in some way. It's called fractional reserve lending. Many banks lend at about, say, 10 to 1. So if you have 10 bucks in your pocket, if you're chartered as a bank, you can lend out $100. Even though you don't have that $100 technically. You sort of write them a instrument, a paper instrument, and then they can spend that $100. It turns into real money for them, and the theory is that you'll pay it back, and there's a sort of inflow and outflow, and it does get complicated eventually. The state can't do that. The state economic development agencies, they put a dollar out, they have to have a dollar in, effectively, or it registers as a loss. So the state economic development agency is not actually a bank. It's just a loan pool. It's a pool of money that can be lent out. If you have $10, you can lend it to someone else, and you can ask that they pay you back $12. But once you lend out that $10, you can't lend out anymore. I realize that I may not be being exactly clear, but I guess I'm trying to distinguish between why people say, you know, why the Wisconsin Economic Development Agency, why state economic development agencies are not actually banks. Now, that's not to say they do a lot of the things that the Bank of North Dakota, that a public bank might do in terms of trying to create, or at least in theory, they try to create local development, economic development within a state. In practice, they may be, you know, paying some multinational company. So that's the first point. And there's a whole set, you know, economic development agencies don't like the idea of a public bank because it's going to take over a lot of what they do. In Vermont, they're looking
why
at
why can't they take over all of the economic development agencies do?
They could. Absolutely. I mean, in North Dakota, basically, a lot of economic development, the majority of it is done through the Bank of North Dakota. And I think more efficiently in some ways. In Vermont, they're talking about taking their economic development agency, the equivalent of that department that you're talking about, Wisconsin, and turning it into a bank because it already does a lot of lending. It's got a lot of the expertise and apparatus to do so. But and we could get into why that hasn't happened. What Wisconsin has done, and a couple other states have done, is to sort of quasi-privatize the economic development agency. So what used to be a totally public entity with public employees, you know, just like the Department of Justice or the Department of Natural Resources, they've spun it off into a quasi-independent sort of private agency that isn't subject to civil service regulations and has a lot more independence. And, you know, let's just say in broad strokes, what has happened in places where that's been done, including in Wisconsin, is that the Economic Development Agency has tended to give more money away to bigger businesses that have less, you know, less interest in and less presence in Wisconsin and get less back. It's basically been unproductive. You know, it's been, I mean, disaster's a little bit strong.
I have this other question before I
So all the other things you're talking about are flow from the fact that the Wisconsin Economic Development Agency was sort of quasi-privatized and have had all kinds of management problems and trouble balancing their books and bad questionable loans and so on.
Could I ask one more question then?
Yes.
We're talking about the payday lending problem.
Yeah.
And I was involved in Model Cities, and that is to try to help poor people get ahead. And I was thinking about one of the projects was consumer counseling one-on-one with people who are in problems, and it could be done by a governmental agency. And one of the things you can do when you're in trouble financially, for instance, if you got a job with a lower income and you can't pay your bills, is to go into Chapter 13 bankruptcy, and if there could be a legal aid society, it would help you get into Chapter 13 bankruptcy, which eliminates your interest altogether, and you pay off the debt in smaller payments that you can't afford. And this would help a lot of people. I don't know if it would help everyone, but I don't know. I think this is a real bad situation for lower-income people, the payday lending problem.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, there are... Bankruptcy is a good solution for people. It comes with certain costs, and I think if you can avoid bankruptcy, it's preferable. There are states that have done some pretty good things around reforming consumer debt laws and consumer sort of the way consumer debt is treated so that people get a lot more information and counseling before they go into bankruptcy. So when the collections agencies come calling, they have to send, you know, there's a lot of disclosure. So California has done pretty good disclosure laws. One of the mountain states, I think Montana maybe has, North Carolina. So they have to tell you exactly, you know, rather than just saying, you need to pay us, we're going to foreclose, you know, seize your car, you're in huge trouble. They have to tell you exactly what the original debt was, exactly how much you owe, what your rights are, what your obligations are. And the truth is that in almost all of these instances, you can negotiate that setup where you pay off a small amount each month. You know, you pay it off over time. You don't lose your car. Your wages aren't garnished. You can negotiate that often directly with the entity that you owe to. You can negotiate it sometimes through legal entities. Through legal aid or otherwise. And in some of these states have given judges discretion to sort of just set up those arrangements. So they say, look, you know, you owe this person this insurance company $3,000, you're making this much, you know, pay them $10 a month for the next X number of years or whatever. You can pay this off. And I think those are all really good ways to deal with consumer debt. States have done that. You basically have to do it at the state level. Bankruptcy too, Chapter 13 bankruptcy can be a way to set that up. There's a certain amount of legal transaction costs with that, and there's reasons I think that it can be, also bankruptcy tends to, you know, poison your credit and your sort of ability sometimes to get, to participate in certain kinds of economic activities going forward. So I don't think I think there are other things that do the same thing that are can take the place of bankruptcy in some cases. But no, I think it's a totally reasonable solution.
I'm interested in what you mentioned about the large deserts, banking deserts. The vast rural areas were 8 miles and miles from any bank, and also the inner city where nobody finds it profitable to be
right.
as a banker. And there's a need for services there, and which is totally non-competitive with the current banking system. They oughtn't to be against it. One of the needs is just for holding money. In the inner city particularly, it's often unsafe to take your cashed check home. Either the neighbors or family members might snitch it, or they might just ask for it, and you can't say no. But if you took your money directly to the post office and put it in an account, or a certain amount of it, then it becomes safe and away from the temptation to just get rid of it. That's one need. They could take the place. And in the rural areas, there's no reason why the postman couldn't take the deposits in with a special envelope or something.
Yeah.
And deposit them into a savings account. I'm thinking of savings accounts rather than checking. And also, I mean, there's a need for savings accounts. And also for, we used to have things like Christmas savings accounts where you put in, it used to be a dollar or two, you know, a week or whatever. And then when December came, you had money to spend for Christmas gifts. That used to be rather popular, as I recall, back in the Depression. I mean, I wasn't doing it then, but I knew about it. And so it's non-competitive, and it is a service, and it helps people to plan their finances by having the cash there that they can think about, you know, and add to. That's one function they could do, and the safety is the other. And there's another function that they could, the postal savings could do is educational. They could help children to put their pennies or dollars in these days into an account that they could watch and get used to the idea of putting their allowance or some portion of their lawn mowing proceeds or babysitting or whatever into an account
right.
or gift monies into an account, and they can look at their book and see what the balance is and get used to the idea of having a savings account. And that could be even through the schools, you know, fostered. So I don't see why that wouldn't, that all could be done under the post office without any lending involved at all. And it would be a great service.
Yeah, absolutely. And that's where that's really where the folks who are proposing the postal service banks are looking to start. Sorry, I'd like to jot down notes because sometimes people ask, like, there's like three or four parts to the question, and I have various thoughts and response, and sometimes I have trouble keeping track of them all. So, I mean, I think starting from the beginning of your question, you make a really good point that there are a whole, not only are there lots of areas where mainstream, you know, sort of too big to fail money center banks are not present, they're actually withdrawing from those areas. They really don't have any interest. I mean, that's the bottom line. Like I said, a lot of these things are high transaction costs, relatively low returns, and these banks can make more money doing other stuff. So banks are actually closing branches, believe it or not, again, in a place where you have all these bank branches and ATMs everywhere. Nationally, banks have closed 2,300 branches. I have this figure somewhere, but and they're basically closing them in low-income and rural areas. You know, you go here, or let's say you go to New York City, and there's a bank branch on every corner, but there are lots of places where they're actually withdrawing from. So you absolutely have need for that kind of access. I think it would be ideal to have people be able to have savings account. So in terms of the cash problem you're talking about, literally people not wanting to be carrying cash on the street, you know, in a cash economy. I mean, you know, there are people who are in this sort of black market or gray market, this sort of, informal economy, and a lot of that does run on cash. But for people who have, that's a relatively small segment of the population in this country. For folks who have, you know, relatively traditional jobs where they're getting paid, regular wages, I think it'd be great to have interest-bearing savings accounts for everyone. But among other things, as you guys know, none of us are really making interest on savings accounts because the interest rates are incredibly low. One of the so the solution that people usually talk about in that regard is these money cards, effectively, sort of, you know, debit cards, where you wouldn't even have a savings account, because that requires a certain amount of infrastructure on the bank side, and also mostly because it spooks the private banks, because then they think, oh, you're getting into the same business we're doing. You literally have a card that when you, you know, almost every business now is capable of doing direct deposit, except for some of the very smallest. The money would go direct, when you got paid your wage every month, it would go directly onto this card, and you could use the card as basically a debit or credit card, which essentially, you know, these days basically is good anywhere. The same for government benefits. Already government, you know, EBT, other kinds of benefits are through a card system that's mostly serviced by the big banks. You could easily, so any money that's flowing into a household could go onto a card, and that's, let's see, I'm now going to finally use this, but these open loop reloadable prepaid cards, I mean, you would basically, it would be back-ended by the same companies. But, you know, essentially, you know, I think we're mostly talking about this, but, you know, it would sit in the place of savings accounts, so people wouldn't have to handle cash and they wouldn't be vulnerable to that. What was the last thing? Oh, and you talked about financial literacy. I mean, yeah, and that's on here as well, and that is certainly, you know, that's something that a lot of people are talking about. There's a sort of, you know, how banking the unbanked and so on. The New America Foundation has done a lot of research and a lot of education around this. There's a big push to try to get folks who are sort of outside of the formal banking system, or just, you know, aren't sort of unaware of the value, frankly, of having a sort of savings account or relationship, to know about that. And, you know, part of the reason there's a lot of efforts around that is because because private industry is supportive of it, because it's basically bringing people, you know, into the system on some level. But I do think financial literacy is a key component, and, you know, there's a need for a banking system, right? There's a genuine advantage to being part of it. Yeah. Well, that's right. And, you know, folks, I was young, but you folks who remember the 80s will remember sort of what happened to savings and loans. You know, they were deregulated. They were given the license to go do things other than just sort of traditional savings and loan. And they promptly went out and, you know, basically made a lot of bad bets. And yes. Well, I think that is the idea, I think. There's a lot of need for sort of vanilla consumer banking services still out there. Although, you know, anyway, I think that's basically true as a blanket assertion. And that's largely what the U.S. Postal Service would do. It would not be doing very fancy, you know, debt instruments and leverage deals. They would be doing very direct and very basic consumer lending. And maybe even things, as I said, that don't really require traditional banking infrastructure, like, wouldn't even necessarily require savings or checking accounts. They would literally just be these cards, these sort of non-bank, quasi-bank services. And frankly, an interesting thing is that in the third world, people often have better access to banking services because they've skipped the sort of bricks and mortar. I don't want to overstate how awesome things are, you know, in Central Africa these days. Like, you know, there's many things that are difficult there, and, you know, there are things that you can only do with a sort of traditional banking edifice. But, you know, in the same way that they sort of skipped having telephone wires and wired phones in a lot of countries and went straight to cell phones, thereby, you know, saving themselves a huge amount of infrastructure investment, they've skipped bricks and mortar traditional banking, and they've gone straight to banking off mobile phones. So there's a system that's used in a lot of Africa, not Douala, it's Pesa, I think, which basically lets people trade credits, which are money, via mobile phone. So, you know, you conduct a transaction with someone. If you both have cell phones, you just, you know, you type in each other's numbers. And it basically functions as banking in a lot of respects, and gets you completely out of the need to have a a single financial, you know, a financial institution that you have a link with to have credit, to have anything. You can literally just sort of, you know, it's almost an alternative currency in a way. And it lets people who are operating in a very informal, very sort of non-place-based way still conduct transactions and not have to carry cash. Sorry.
I had a second question. This is regarding the energy monopolies like they have in Wisconsin, where basically they are proposing to change the structure so the core charge they have, or they're increasing it extremely high and not for energy. So when you had mentioned about all these green things regarding, well, you know, the solar and everything else where you can save money and improving your homes, they have now just decided to destroy that. And I'm sure that's in other energy places around the country. So my question is, how do you fix that? How do you say that we don't need these grids all over the place, and therefore we can produce it locally from those who are saving it and using solar? And thank you.
Sure. Let me say two things that hopefully are responsive and sort of answer your question. I mean, one is that, okay, so yeah, you're right. There's this proposed change in the way utility pricing is structured that, if you guys haven't heard about and haven't noticed, it's a terrible idea, and you should know about it. So basically, they would change it from, essentially, and this is something that's being pushed all over the country. It came straight out of ALEC, straight from the sort of big energy companies. The idea is that rather than having a relatively low base rate, you know, so you look at your utility bill and you pay $10 plus 0.2357692, whatever, you know, per kilowatt hour, you would basically pay a base rate of $30 or $50, and then almost nothing for usage. You know, you'd pay a few bucks each month depending on your usage. The idea being that it would basically remove any incentive to decrease your usage and would guarantee that the utilities make the same amount of money irrespective. It basically, you know, tries to counteract the effects of energy efficiency and saving money and of renewables on some level. Utilities, and especially the fossil fuel industry, likes this for obvious reasons, because it takes away the incentive for people to save money at all. You can use all you want. You get charged essentially the same amount. It's a terrible idea for obvious reasons, I think. And this is a basic problem in the current way we run utilities. I mean, and I should say the historical way. We've run utilities the same way for a long, long time, which is basically to pay them more the more energy people use. And, it aligns the incentives in exactly the wrong way. Utilities have an incentive to make people use more energy because then they get paid more. It's a bigger topic that we could talk about. But anyway, that's a terrible idea that should be opposed. It's being pushed in a lot of states, not just Wisconsin. Wisconsin just happens to, you know, have a sort of policy or a political alignment that makes it relatively likely to pass. That doesn't exactly, if that policy change goes through, it's going to remove a lot of the sort of, it's going to remove some of the financial logic for doing certain kinds of energy efficiency things and certain kinds of, you know, renewable energy changes. So, you know, you might, normally if you insulated your roof and you were paying X amount each month for additional energy usage and you are saving money, you're using less energy to heat your house, saving money, you get paid back over, say, 10 years. Now that, you know, you basically are paying the same amount every month, it's going to take you 50 years or something to pay that back. So it makes a lot less sense to do that. That's an ancillary bad effect of that change. I guess I would say, in terms of the sort of big picture, in terms of the really big picture, I mean, you know, it doesn't, fossil fuels are going to get more and more expensive. We're going to keep putting carbon in the air and polluting the environment and so on. So in some sense, this is, you know, the utilities can do whatever they want with the rate structures in the short term, but the states that are able to, you know, set up incentives, like using this Green Bank or using anything, that are able to set up incentives for energy efficiency are going to be in better shape in the future. I mean, you know, assuming that we have one, right, and are going to, you know, going to be working to make sure that the planet's still around when our grandchildren are here. My grandchildren. Anyway. But, I mean, you know, it doesn't make the Green Bank any less of a necessary or things like that, less of a necessary or smart policy innovation, even though it would make it difficult to implement in this state. Overall, I think it still would be it's still a useful way to think about doing things. Yeah.
Yeah. That brings to mind the outrage of the current utility. When I was back in the Pacific Northwest, they believed in lifeline rates, which is a fixed amount that everybody gets at a low cost, and then a high marginal rate to discourage use and so forth after that. And they're going to exactly the opposite now with Madison Gas and Electric, with their head tax approach. Instead of $10 a month, it's going to be $60 a month or whatever they can gouge out of us. Let's support the 1% type approach. Mm-hmm. And instead, of course, then it keeps the rates lower and encourages more use of electricity on the margin, because they're absorbing all this nonsense, endless billing. I mean, as an accountant and as a CPA, the cost of record keeping is not worth the benefit sometimes.
Yeah.
And I think that's the same with the city going to the water bills, is going to bill monthly instead of every 6 months, which just increases the record keeping cost and burdens the poor people and enriches the rich.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I think you make a good point about what it's, you know, what the sort of side effects of that are going to be. And I think it's, you know, it's interesting to think there's lots of ways in which cost structures and which sort of market incentives, basically how you price things in a market, can drive behavior, right? I mean, anyone, it's sort of intuitive point, and of course it's a thing that economists talk about all the time. And I think it's funny how folks, I'm going to say on the right, but also, you know, people who spend a lot of time talking about how awesome free markets are often in the position of saying, oh, but we shouldn't price things, you know, according to how much they're costing society or according to what we want people to do. You know, we should, they're basically wanting to take utilities increasingly out of the market, right? Just pay them a flat fee, you know. We're not going to negotiate over a price. We're not going to think about what things cost. We're just going to give them money no matter what. I mean, it's ironic that folks who spend a lot of their time talking about how consumers should all be subject to the free market are themselves very interested in not really being subject to those forces. And I think, yeah, right? Yes, exactly. You know, low taxes for us, but you guys should still pay taxes. But I think there's lots of interesting ways that pricing can be used to drive behavior and to disincentivize, things that are socially costly. So, you know, all kinds of ways that you can price driving. You can price water usage that we don't price water usage, basically. Energy usage, use of infrastructure, use of facilities, stormwater. These are all things that industry use on a massive scale, and we could be charging them for it, but we don't. We basically, you know, no matter how much stormwater runoff you have, no matter how much you put into the, you know, discharge you have, we basically don't charge you for that, or we charge a very, very low marginal rate.
Well, we need to end the question-answer session here, and once again, I want to thank you, Sam, for a very interesting.
Thanks.
Yeah. And I'm going to turn things over to Dan Cornwell now. I hope you'll stay and listen.
Yeah, absolutely.
Yes. Yes.
Related announcement. My name is Dave Leeper. I was recently a candidate for state treasurer promoting public banking. I am now lost my primary, and I'm trying to sell off the books for public banking, which I used to use to fund my campaign. So if anybody is willing to give a donation of $20 or more, you get this $25 book. So they're back there. If this public banking is interesting to you, you can pick up a book today and also help me out with my debt. Thank you.
Let's see. I'm Dan Cornwell. And you may have picked up on the way in a sheet I wrote one page about a study group on reforming the Federal Reserve System. And I don't want to go through that now. If you didn't pick one up, please pick it up on the way out. The idea here is to have a group, if you're interested, that might be meeting about every 2 weeks at Capitol Lakes. And it would be studying alternatives to the way the Fed, the way the system creates new money. And just to put that into context, as Sam mentioned, if you're an individual and you have $10, you could lend it out, and maybe after a period of time, you have 12. If you are a bank and you have $10, you can lend out 90. You have to keep some on reserve, but you can lend out 90, and you, if you get the same rate of return, you see you get a lot more money back. Now, these are all private banks, except for maybe a few public banks, like the Bank of North Dakota that's doing this. And this is a terribly inefficient way. As our economy grows, new money is created each year, and that should be spent in a way that benefits the public interest, not just in a way that gets the best return from banks, especially those who are now playing games with financial intricate deals. So, if you're interested, I guess one other thing I want to say is that all the things Sam talked about, let's say more than half a dozen, that might be done differently. These are things that can all be done. We can imagine them at least getting done within our lifetime in a reasonable period of time. Changing the system I'm describing, of course, will not happen anytime soon, and I've explained the pros and cons. But the idea is to look into and think about an alternative arrangement, and when the next big crash comes, maybe people will be ready to do it. So that's a very long term rather than what we could do today. Also, I would say it's a study group. You're not going to come and hear lectures and so on. Members who are there should participate. Go out, I have some references, but you have to go out and see what proposals are out there, come and tell the group about them, and discuss them, and so on. If you're interested in that, I have a sign-up sheet, which I have lost. One of the things you need to do is be organized. So, as you go out, if you think you might be interested, please sign up on that sheet and give either a telephone or email address by which I can, so that I can communicate with you. We'll try to find a time. It may not be Saturday morning. It may be 2 p.m. Monday or something like that. So sign up if you're interested. Take that sheet if you're interested. And thanks again to Sam for giving us such great background.